From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk about why auto insurance is so expensive in Michigan.
If you have unlimited benefits, no reasonable cost controls, you know, what do you expect?
Then a chat with Wayne County Executive Warren Evans about the county budget and roads.
Whether it's a four-lane roadway or a one-lane roadway, it's a linear mile, which to me is lunacy. I mean, obviously, repairing four lanes is significantly more costly than repairing one.
Two Michigan members of Congress urge Immigration and Customs Enforcement to stop deportation proceedings on a journalist seeking asylum.
And this man was doing an invaluable service to people in this country, putting the spotlight on wrongdoing.
We talked to Free Press reporter Allie Gross about her investigation into a county land bank, and we've got a cocktail for St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, it turned out just like I wanted it to.
This green cocktail is a whole lot better than green beer.
Anything's better than green beer, Lester.
Welcome to Stateside. Hi, I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, Congressional Representatives Fred Upton and Debbie Dingell are urging Immigration and Customs Enforcement to stop the deportation of a Mexican journalist seeking asylum.
We need to make it clear to the government at all levels in this country that there are reasons for justifiable asylum.
Later in the hour, an update on Emilio Gutierrez Soto. But first, there's a lot of confusion as to why auto no-fault insurance is so high. A lot of politicians point to the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, the MCCA. We're going to try to explain what that is, and I want to start by reading to you the MCCA's description of what it does. The Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, a private, nonprofit, unincorporated association, was created by the state legislature in 1978. Michigan's unique auto insurance no-fault law provides unlimited lifetime coverage for medical expenses which result from auto accidents. The MCCA reimburses auto no-fault insurance companies for each personal injury protection medical claim paid in excess of a set amount, and currently that amount is $555,000. That means the insurance company pays the entire claim but is reimbursed by the MCCA for medical costs over $555,000. All auto insurance companies operating in Michigan are assessed to cover the catastrophic medical claims occurring in Michigan. Those assessments are generally passed on to auto insurance policyholders. The assessment right now is $192 per vehicle for per year. Joining me to once again talk about the MCCA and auto no-fault insurance are our Friday political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. And Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican Senate Majority Leader. So, Vicki, if all this additional coverage is costing drivers $192 per car per year, why are we seeing sky-high insurance rates that exceed like $2,000 in some cases?
That's a good question, and it can't all be the result of Michigan's no-fault auto insurance. There are a lot of factors that go into setting insurance rates for automobiles, and Michigan has among the highest rates. But a lot of that is due to the fact that we have a lot of uninsured motorists. We do not have an insurance bureau that oversees rates before they're used, and there's no accounting for how these rates are calculated in the first place. So while we're paying $192 a year for catastrophic claims benefits, should you be in a catastrophic car crash for life, your health insurance is covered, there's no accounting for the other $2,300 that people are paying in the average insurance bill in the state of Michigan.
Ken, in considering this MCCA, should we look at it as sort of a reinsurer like Lloyd's of London?
Well, I look at it as kind of a reinsurance mechanism, kind of a insurance company for insurance companies. And it basically, as you pointed out, it pays for any claim above $550,000. You know, it's a mechanism created. I think the assumption was, you know, you can't just have individual insurance companies receive those claims because just kind of by luck of the draw, you know, you could bankrupt a couple of insurance companies. So it's a pooling mechanism for all of these claims that are above $550,000, which you need because Michigan has unlimited medical benefits.
The MCCA has long been criticized for its lack of transparency, and that's coming up again from legislators. While it was created by the state of Michigan, it's exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. The public doesn't get to look at the books. MCCA officials in the past have said, look, it's way too complicated for you to understand anyway. Vicki, what do you think of having $20 billion fund that we all pay into held by a state-created entity but run by insurance industry, which does not want us reviewing their assessments?
It's not only that they don't want us to review what they've got, they are not even subject to the Open Meetings Act, where they allow people to come in and just watch the proceedings and see what's going on. So we don't know what their actuarial numbers are. But again, we keep blaming personal injury protection for life, unlimited benefits, for the high cost of our insurance rates. And that's one component. The other components are how cars are repaired, the density of traffic in an area, and a whole host of other things, including the number of uninsured motorists. But the $192 annual fee comes nowhere near close to recognizing how our rates got so high in the first place and why they've persisted in remaining so high. So there's a lot that needs to be done with auto insurance in whole and not just looking at the unlimited lifetime health care protections that Michigan graciously and wonderfully provides. And if you ever know anybody in a catastrophic crash who is injured for life, this is just a godsend to a family.
Ken, this week the MCCA officials blamed the high cost of no-fault insurance on waste and fraud by doctors and hospitals and other healthcare entities. What do you think of that claim?
Well, waste and fraud in this case is simply a function, in my opinion, of not having any kind of real cost controls in this system, such as a fee schedule, which is normal in the health insurance business. But you don't have it when it comes to auto insurance medical claims. So there probably is what they would call waste and fraud or abuse. But once again, I think it's the function of not having cost controls or, frankly, not having any kind of limits on medical benefits in Michigan.
Yeah, some of the examples that they've shown is a medical procedure might cost, figuratively, $1 at one hospital and $7 at another hospital, and this fee schedule would establish a set fee like health insurance companies have negotiated for themselves. Vicki, would that fix the problem?
Again, we can talk about the healthcare portion all we want. That's $192 of these over $2,500 auto insurance bills on an annual basis, average across the state of Michigan.
Well, no, let me stop you there, because I'm going to argue with you a little bit, because that $555,000 worth of coverage is what we're talking about paying for. That's part of the major cost, and that's what their point is, maybe a fee schedule that covers that $555,000 and beyond is part of the reason it's so high, and we don't have a fee schedule for that.
Well, let me just take an example. 10 years ago, I broke my ankle. I needed surgery. That was covered by my health insurance. That was $27,000 for a broken ankle. $27,000 with a fee schedule and negotiated fee prices. So you can quickly see, even if you have negotiated prices, how quickly you hit that $555,000 cap. Now, the auto insurance companies are right when they say people are living longer, and so the cost of taking care of somebody for life is extended. But again, we're talking about over $2,000 of an auto insurance bill that has nothing to do with health care. It all boils down again to the status of health care and health insurance and the need for comprehensive health care reform in the state of Michigan and across the country. Now, when you just look at this, if you were to eliminate the personal injury protection in these policies and go back to the old system, people will quickly blow through their caps and their limits and end up on Medicaid. And Medicaid is paid for by the citizens of the state. So do we want to blow up the Medicaid system, or do we want to come together and figure out a way why repairing a car is so expensive, How do we control those costs? How do we get the rates down? How do we increase competition in insurance rates? How do we oversee insurance rates through the Insurance Commission in the state of Michigan to maintain a control mechanism for them? And then let's talk about also a fee schedule for attendant care and other things that are part of the personal injury protection.
We've only got about a minute left. I want to ask you one more quick question. I've been seeing people on social media say, and the MCCA, take that $20 billion and spend it on fixing the roads. But if the MCCA is ended, those billions are not going to the state or to ratepayers. Ken, where's it go?
Well, the MCCA is designed, as we've been talked about, to pay for these claims that are above $550,000. And, you know, it's not even fair, much less being realistic, to say take that money and spend it on roads. I mean, because that money's committed to take care of people that have been injured. But, you know, I'll go back to sort of, you know, kind of a fundamental belief I have is that if you have unlimited benefits, no reasonable cost controls, you know, what do you expect? Michigan has the highest rates in the country. And 20% of the drivers, because of that, are driving without insurance. It's not a sustainable system.
Vicki, you get the last word.
Well, you asked a question about what happens if personal injury protection is dissolved in the state of Michigan. A certain portion of that $20-plus billion will stay in reserves to maintain health care for those who were injured prior to the dissolution of the current laws. But most of that money would then be distributed not back to the ratepayers or the people who paid into it, but to the insurance companies themselves. So they have a big stake in trying to get all of this changed so they can get their hands on the money.
That is our explanation of MCCA. Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. You hear them most Fridays right here on Stateside. Have a great weekend, you two.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Coming up, we'll be talking with Free Press reporter Allie Gross about her investigation into the Wayne County Land Bank and the program Action Before Auction.
Homes are being pulled without a clear understanding of who is inside of the homes, if they're occupied or not. And then they're being sold to developers.
Stick around. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I was looking over my last heating bill, and we used more natural gas for the period than we had for the previous 2 years, so you can blame the polar vortex for that. My statement also shows how my use compares to other houses in my area, and actually, we use a lot less than most of them. We get some good insulation, a pretty efficient furnace, and keeping the thermostat down helps a lot. But insulating and a new furnace are not cheap, and that's why an interesting program is worth your attention. It's called Michigan Saves, and it's being called the nation's first nonprofit green bank. Joining us is Selma Tucker with Michigan Saves. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you for having me.
All right, what does green bank mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. Green bank is really a term of art and is shorthand for an organization that is completely focused on enabling financing or capital to help people make energy improvements, being energy efficiency or renewable energy, and sometimes green infrastructure improvements to their home, their business, their house of worship, or any building that consumes energy.
Well, let's break all of that down. First, how did Michigan Saves get started?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we are the nation's first nonprofit green bank in this state. Out of Public Act 295 in 2008 asked a really prescient question which was, how do we take our precious and limited and very few resources and turn those resources into a solution that helps everybody in the state of Michigan be able to do this really powerful work on their building, that work being energy efficiency or renewable energy. And so they said, we got a little bit of money and we have a lot of people and we have a lot of need. How do we do that? Because we know that financing these things are important and expensive. And out of that question came Michigan Saves, which was capitalized with that small amount of money. In this case, it was $6.5 million from the state of Michigan to create a green bank that would serve as a financing institution for everyone in the state of Michigan to be able to insulate their house, be able to make their home more comfortable, be able to keep those drafty floors from being so cold, and ultimately bring down those energy bills.
Well, $6 million on its own is not going to go very far doing that. So how'd you leverage more money with that?
That $6.5 million, as well as some money that we got from the federal government shortly after 2008, we got an extra $5 million. The state got a grant to do that. That money has been sitting in what is called a loan loss reserve, which is just a fancy term for money we hold in trust. And we go to our credit unions and our lenders in the state who have plenty of money to lend to our residents. And we say, hey, if we hold this money in trust for you and promise to cover losses in the event that something happens in the event of a default, do you promise to lend money at incredibly favorable terms? That will help all these people, all these commercial businesses and all these commercial operations and residential families. And they said, you know, this sounds like a crazy experiment. We have no idea how to underwrite an energy efficiency loan. So it's good that you've got that backstop for us. But yes, we will do it because we have that guarantee. And we've seen a really explosive success and explosive demand for this product, for this energy efficiency and renewable energy product, because people all over the state are wondering how to protect themselves and ensure that they're prepared for a weather event that is going to stress their home and eventually stress their family.
Okay, you got my attention with low interest loans, but what kind of interest rates are we talking about with these loans?
Yeah, we are talking interest rates that rival mortgages, that rival 30-year mortgages. We're talking interest rates at 4.99%, 5.25%. And that's for an unsecured loan, which is a relatively wonky term, but the best kind of credit to compare to is a credit card, because credit cards carry, as we know, you're lucky if you're getting a credit card at 10% interest, but they're usually much higher than that. So because of the power of our loan loss reserve, we have been able to get our lenders to say, this is a safe product. I have insurance in the event that something happens. And that savings and that low interest just gets passed right on to the customer, and they're able to do their energy project in their home or in their commercial building for a fraction that it would cost them through virtually any other product. That's why, particularly on our residential side, our residential product is the envy of the nation, and we go around at times to other states and we help them stand up a green bank just like Michigan Saves.
I want to talk about what kind of improvements. You listed some of them early, but I'm wondering if there's a safety measure here, because, you know, there are some people who say, boy, I'm going to get geothermal and get it installed in my house, and yet they haven't even insulated it properly. I mean, is there any kind of protocol for what you can and can't do with your house with one of these loans?
Our mission is to make sure that energy efficiency and renewable energy can happen in any building in this state, because it is such a powerful tool and there are so many uses for it. Where and how we come down on that, we have a big long list that we call the eligible measures list, where anybody can look and see, you know, can I get this furnace? Can I get these windows? Energy efficient roofs. You may not know that there are energy efficient roofs out there. There's lots of stuff. There's so many opportunities in our buildings to be able to make them more efficient. And we want to finance all of those opportunities. We don't want to turn our back on any of them. But at the end of the day, the contractor that you hire will determine a scope of work that works for you and your project and your building. And if it is going to reduce energy consumption, Michigan Saves will finance it.
Some of the energy utilities in the state also are offering rebates for these improvements. Sometimes they hit a limit, though. Do you have any idea what the best time of the year is to make sure you can get the loan from Michigan Saves and a rebate if the utility offers it?
Yeah, we love those sort of stackable resources. You can get a Michigan Saves loan at any time because we are at scale. We are turnkey. Anyone under the sound of this voice and under the sound of your voice, Lester, can get a Michigan Saves loan at any part of the year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Doesn't even matter if it's Christmas. We love it when our utility partners, and they are partners, they give those rebates because those rebates help our customers bring down the cost of that improvement even more. And those utility rebates, usually, I believe they start at the beginning of the year, and they go until funds are exhausted. So, I would be looking out for the emails that your utility sends you about, and they send them all the time, the emails that your utility sends you about the rebates that are available, and just take a close look at when they say they may expire. We know the need is out there, and we just need to make sure that people understand that this resource exists, and they should absolutely be taking advantage of it.
Okay, where are you online?
You can visit us at michigansaves.org, find a qualified contractor, and we think you should get started on that energy project right away.
Selma Tucker is Director of Marketing and Communications for Michigan Saves. Thanks much.
Thank you.
A Free Press investigative report brings up some serious questions about the Wayne County program to keep people in their homes rather than sell those properties at auction. The reporter is Allie Gross, and she joins me now. Welcome back.
Hi, Lester. Thank you for having me.
So this program is called Action Before Auction, and it's run by the Wayne County Land Bank. What is this program supposed to be doing to keep homeowners in their homes?
Sure. So the program, it's not just about keeping homeowners in their homes. The program is supposed to remediate the negative consequences of the tax auction. So we're talking about speculation, blight, and displacement. In reality, when put into action, what we found is, at least for the displacement level, for sure, homes are being pulled without a clear understanding of who is inside of the homes, if they're occupied or not. And then they're being sold to developers.
You mean pull out of the auction?
Yeah. So, yes, exactly. So the developers are the partners, not the occupants. And it's upon that developer to check if the home is occupied and then decide if the occupant is eligible or not. The Wayne County Land Bank then certifies this. And what we've found is many people living in homes that are foreclosed in Detroit that are pulled to be part of this program are struggling when it comes to proving their eligibility to the developers in the Wayne County Land Bank.
You even reported that some of these developers don't even visit the home to find out if they're occupied before pulling them.
So, right. So the developers get to decide which homes they're interested in having the county pull for them. And so they're picking some of the best homes, but they don't know if they're occupied or not. In one case that we focused on in the story, a man, Lorenzo Slade, is speaking on the phone with the developer who purchased his house. And the developer said to him, I've never been to the house before. And the developer at that point was the owner. And here's Lorenzo sitting in his living room that he's lived in for 45 years. And it's this man who's never been to the house before telling him he now owns it. And at that point, Lorenzo had already gotten an eviction notice.
Well, let's go through this sure. Bit by bit because you make several points about this program. Let's start with this. You report few occupants have a real shot at reclaiming their homes. That's supposed to be the goal of the program. Why is it falling short?
Sure. So there are two reasons why this can happen. First reason is Wayne County Land Bank, for example, they tout when they look at their 2017 program, it's a huge success in terms of keeping people in their homes. And the statistic that they like to use is 75% of occupants received an offer. What that statistic does not share, and the reason why it's misleading, is receiving an offer doesn't mean you actually got to purchase your home back. Receiving an offer means either a purchase offer, but that the developer can tack on an additional $5,000. So if you already were struggling to pay your taxes, that additional $5,000 can be a real burden that maybe would preclude you from being able to repurchase your home. An offer can also mean a rental agreement, which only lasts for 1 year. So after that year, that developer now just owns that house or property. And the third would be cash for keys, $5,000 cash for keys, which the county considers to be a success. In their opinion.
So they're basically saying there's not a chance you're going to get this house, so why don't you give us the keys to the house, we'll give you $5,000.
That's one of the, and people can take that instead. And so in reality, that 75%, if you dig into that number, it's actually only 20% actually purchased their home through the program in 2017. And the county's argument is that's a better outcome than the auction. If these homes went to auction, a speculator could buy it and they could just sit on it. These people could be evicted. But from the opinion of advocates and people working around this, if you're going to intervene in the auction, do better than it. You know, that is kind of the opinion there.
You then show how developers picked by the Wayne County Land Bank are being sold properties for pennies on the dollar and making a lot of profit. How much are we talking about?
It's a lot of money, millions of dollars. So the properties that are being sold to developers are paying the taxes owed, which we're talking it could be anywhere from $1,000 to maybe $15,000 max is the taxes owed, full taxes owed, and then a very small admin fee between $500 and I think $1,500, depending on how many properties the developer is pulling. So let's say we focus on one developer in the piece, FPJ Investments. They pulled in the 2017 program 40 properties. They pulled them for about $250,000. So when we did the math, it ended up being just a little under $6,000 per property. They purchased 17 in the city of Detroit. So let's say using that figure, they spent a little under $95,000 buying properties in Detroit. When we looked in February, so last month, at that outcome of those 17 properties, FPJ had sold 12 of them for $1.89 million.
Okay. The original investment was?
$95,000.
And
they got $1.89 million.
Wow.
But the land bank will point out, well, FPJ Investment, they're investing. They're not just, you know, getting the properties and selling them immediately. Part of the program, at least the first year, was if the property was quote-unquote vacant, meaning an occupant wasn't eligible, or truly was vacant, but majority were occupied, the investor had to put $25,000 into each house at least. So, you know, sure, let's say FPJ, when we looked at the data in August, they had spent about $400,000 on 15 of the 17 Detroit properties. So let's say even they doubled that and put in $800,000, which would be way over what the program was asking of them, they would still make about $1 million in profit just from those 12 properties. And then we're not talking about they still have the rest of the 40, you know, to make up the rest of their inventory.
Your report also says Wayne County Land Bank is giving these developers remarkable flexibility within the program. What does that mean?
Sure. So when we looked at it, so year one of the program, there was a lot of controversy because there was no RFP, which is a request for proposal. So there were 9 developers the first year, and they were all handpicked. And at least 3 of them, we wrote about it that year, had ties to the county. Second year, there was an application. When people were selected, which would be they were selected in April 2018 when organizations were selected, at least 3 of the organizations had been in the program the year before and were delinquent on their taxes for properties.
These are developers who bought property the year before and now were delinquent on their properties and they were accepted into the program.
And they were accepted into the program. Again, they did end up paying their taxes, their belated taxes, in about July, right before they actually were able to receive the deeds for these new properties. But one thing that's kind of pointed out is that that's the same issue a lot of the folks who get ensnared in kind of the tax auction drama are dealing with as well, that they're going to pay at the last minute in July or August. And in fact, when they go down to pay, they're being told, no, you can't actually redeem your property, but you're in this great program and you will have a chance to stay. And as, you know, the reporting found, it was really difficult for many people to stay.
The Wayne County Land Bank's executive director, Daniel Rosenbaum, disputes your findings. And he says, at the very least, you know, this is doing something more for the residents than the auction does. Now, what evidence did he offer to back up that statement?
Oh, well, it's the evidence of, you know, the $5,000 cash for keys. It's the rental agreement. It's the argument that had these properties gone to auction, this would be a better outcome. His argument is, so the way right of refusal works, the county would be the last to be able to pull out properties pre-auction. So he's saying, we were the last. These were definitely slated. This program ultimately shows the flaws really of the auction and the kind of malleability of the auction, because while technically these homes were foreclosed. They should be slated for auction. As is pointed out, many people have been able to go all the way up until August. And if they can get in front of Treasurer Eric Sabree and pay their taxes in full, they've been able to pull out their properties. There's also the point, so United Community Housing Coalition, Ted Phillips, their director, told this kind of, he said red flags were raised for him for this program when they do a right of first refusal program with the City of Detroit. The City of Detroit's program, the occupants are the partners, not the developers. They pull 500 homes. It's a very simple transaction. And a client came to Ted and said, my home, she had gotten behind on her taxes because of a land contract issue, and she could not, Ted wanted to see if they can pull it late for the city's program. And when he went to go see if he could pull it, Wayne County Land Bank said, we already pulled, it's ours, we already pulled it.
So the city has a similar program, except it's a little more effective.
It's more effective, and it costs less, there's no $5,000 fee tacked on, all of these other things. So Ted was saying, well, if this is a better program for this person, if she would be able to keep her home, pay less, why wouldn't the county let the city do it? And the argument from the county was kind of, we got here first, sorry. And that was a red flag of who are we trying to help, the people in the city, or is it developers?
Allie Gross is the reporter behind an in-depth report on Wayne County's auction program and its shortcomings. You can find it on the Free Press website. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Up next, we'll be talking to Wayne County Executive Warren Evans and asking him about the county budget and a shortage of money. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Wayne County Executive, Warren Evans, delivered his State of the County address yesterday, and he joins us now to give us a brief overview. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, Lester. Great to be back.
Property values and taxes were at the top of the list in a couple of different ways. Let's start with the fact that, like a lot of municipalities, the Great Recession devastated the housing market. It's since recovered, but tax revenue is way down. Why?
Well, it's way down because of Headley and Prop A, and it's far more painful, I think, for counties around the state because we have a much more significant reliance on property taxes. Headley and Prop A do a great job when your property values go down. It drops immediately, but based on Headley and Prop A, the ability for the property taxes to catch up with the current home values is significantly limited, and so for an example, in Wayne County, for the last 4 years, as we were coming out of our financial problems, we were doing it with about $100 million less than the revenue that we had in 07, which is 25% less general fund revenue. And that's pretty significant.
Some municipalities have suggested changing Prop A or rethinking the Headley Amendment to the Constitution. What are you thinking about? What might be the answer?
I'm not so sure that I have any answer other than the one you just mentioned, and I certainly think that that's a feasible approach. We certainly don't want people paying taxes over and above the assessed values of their homes, but I think as the taxes go down with the down market, there has to be a better mechanism for the tax revenue to catch back up. I mean, the expectation is that we will provide quality services to our constituents, and if we do that, we actually bring quality to the neighborhoods, which really helps the value. And conversely, if we don't have the money, it can be detrimental.
Well, let's talk about Wayne County's overall finances. You talked about how much less you're getting now than you did. The roads and bridges need attention. Your park system's not well-funded. Your pension funds are underfunded. You still have to provide public services, but you have a lot less money to do that. So how do you deal with it?
Well, you just you worry about it at night and you try to manage your budget as best you can. We've had 4 years of balanced budgets now and budget surpluses, but what few people understand is we need the surpluses to be able to have that influx of cash to be able to put back in the pension system. It's not there for general service provision uses, and so When I took office, we were 45% funded in our pension fund. At the end of last year, we were up to 61%. But 80% is really the minimum that you should have to feel comfortable that you have a stable retirement system. So we've got an awful long way to go. And with no large influxes of cash, that might be a 10-year process of siphoning off surpluses that could be used to enhance county services to pour back into pensions.
As you mentioned, Wayne County has some of the most traveled roads in the state. The governor, Gretchen Whitmer, has proposed a phased-in 45-cent fuel tax to fix the roads. Is that what you need, and would you get enough money fast enough?
Well, there are two questions there, and I don't totally have the answers to. I mean, what I think is that the governor has done a good job of not trying to put a Band-Aid on the problem. I mean, I think what she's proposing is something that would actually move us in the right direction in terms of our road repairs. Now, you know, is that the best methodology to do it? You know, I guess I'm not so sure. But I learned a long time ago that if I wanted to be governor, I'd have to run for it. And so I try to support initiatives that will help to move us in the right direction and let other people quibble about whether that's the best way to raise the money. The second part of the question is, will it raise enough? Certainly, if it was allocated through what we call Act 51 dollars, which is traditional road funding, it certainly would not be enough because the funding mechanism for Act 51 is it borders on lunacy as far as I'm concerned.
In what way?
We receive money based on the amount of linear miles that each area has. Whether it's a four-lane roadway or a one-lane roadway, it's a linear mile, which to me is lunacy. I mean, obviously, repairing four lanes is significantly more costly than repairing one, but there's no difference in the formula between those two extremes. And there is nothing in the formula that talks about the degradation to the roads from trucks and other things. I mean, clearly, Wayne County is going to have far more damage to the roads with overweight trucks and the amount of traffic we have at, four sports venues and an international border. It's a little different than traveling through Ishpeming.
So do you need an immediate cash infusion to get things kickstarted?
Well, we need an immediate cash infusion, but if the cash infusion comes in the same formula that we've been receiving dollars, we're still going to be significantly underfunded, I think, is the issue.
Gotcha.
That I'm talking about. And clearly with what we do now, if we make the best use of the Act 51 dollars we have, we still aren't improving overall the roads in Wayne County. And that's an impending disaster that we'd like to stave off.
In your State of the County address, you also called for a review of the payment plans that the county offers to people to catch up on their property taxes rather than lose their homes to foreclosure. What are your concerns about those payment plans?
Well, the concern in a nutshell is, are they working? I think payment plans that will make it easier for people to stay in their homes and keep their properties is absolutely a great thing, and I support it 100%. I don't have the data to know whether these payment plans are really working or not. There's the issue of keeping up with the payment plan, and there's also the issue of keeping up with the ongoing current taxes. And if all of that's being met, and we're giving people an opportunity to keep their houses that would have had it before, it's wonderful. But if we're kicking the can down the road because significant numbers of people are not able to keep up with the payment plans, and thus we're, just forestalling foreclosure for a couple more years, then that's not so good. And so I don't know what the answer is, but we'll be seeking the data and review in the very near future to try to come up with some assessment of just how effective that's working.
The Detroit Free Press columnist Nancy Kaffer took you to task about statements you made during a meeting with the newspaper's editorial board. She wrote that you referred to the money from the auction of foreclosed houses as blood money. Her conclusion is, if you don't want blood money, you should do something about it. What do you think of that assessment?
Well, I think it's a silly assessment, number one. What I said was, we would much rather have people in their homes than collect what's frequently referred to as DTRF funds. As a social imperative, I would much rather never receive DTRF funds if people are in their homes and able to pay their taxes. If DTRF funds become available because of the auction process. Of course, I'm not going to turn the money back. I mean, you've heard me talk for quite a while about the county's deficit and our underfunding in the first place. The point I'm making here is I would much rather have people in their homes and have a foreclosure process that makes more sense than the existing one to hopefully lessen that. I mean, if I receive less money in delinquent tax dollars, then my job is to manage with what I have, and I'll manage all day smiling if it's a situation where people are able to maintain their homes, which are really their biggest investments for most people in their life.
Warren Evans is the Wayne County Executive. We've been talking about his State of the County address yesterday. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Happy to be here.
We've been following the story of a Mexican journalist who was being threatened at home because of his reporting on crimes by Mexican soldiers. Emilio Gutierrez Soto and his son Oscar entered the United States seeking asylum because they feared for their lives.
This can be a very dangerous profession in Mexico, as I believe there might be some 130 journalists that have been killed in the last 10 years.
Right now, Gutierrez Soto is a recipient of a University of Michigan Knight Wallace Fellowship for Journalists. The federal government is working to deport him and his son. This week, U.S. Representatives Debbie Dingell and Fred Upton sent a letter to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE. The members of Congress urged ICE to stop the deportation case. Joining us now is Representative Dingell. So why did you get involved in this particular case over any of the other deportation cases in your district?
Well, this is not the only case that I'm involved in, and there are many people that I am trying to help. So I want to say that. I have become involved in this case because it was brought to my attention by a number of people at the University of Michigan, and very clearly, Emilio, if he were to return to Mexico's life is being threatened, and he and his family would be living in very difficult circumstances. This country is a place where people need to be able to seek political asylum. Many of the people that are working with him have talk about what a good person he is. He was doing his job, documenting crimes committed by Mexican soldiers. And, you know, since he's been here, he's abided by the U.S. laws, fully cooperated. And we have to protect a free press. And this, for me, as much as it is about anything else, is protecting a free press.
In addition to sending a letter to ICE, you've also introduced a private bill, in other words, a bill specific to one person. What would happen if that was approved?
So I want to be very clear I'm trying to change the policy again on what these private bills do. They used to be a lot more successful. But by a member introducing a private bill, immigration understands that we are really taking a very strong stand, that this is something we're concerned about. Fred had heard about this case as much as I had, and when we found out that his case for asylum had been denied, I said, Fred, we need to do this in a bipartisan way. Will you do a letter with me? When you do private bills, you are not allowed to have co-sponsors. But I have been talking to a number of my colleagues throughout the House, and we are looking at further things that we can do on a bipartisan way that shows that somebody can do their job and not face death threats and harassment from a military and from the government. No one should be killed doing their job.
I'm wondering, you and Fred Upton, Congressman Upton, wrote this letter together. When members of Congress send letters and introduce bills like that, how much effect does it have on a federal agency's actions?
Well, I don't know, which is why we are trying to document, and I would ask everybody who's listening to this, who cares about a freedom of the press, that we need to create. We need to make it clear to the government at all levels in this country that we need to halt his deportation and that there are reasons for justifiable asylum. And this is one person and his family that deserve it. Mexico remains the deadliest country for journalists worldwide that's not engaged in armed conflict. And we've already had two journalists murdered in this country this year. These are legitimate, documented concerns surrounding Emilio's safety. And who are we as America and the United States if we are not going to fight for one of the fundamental pillars of our Constitution, which is freedom of the press?
News media organizations and advocates for a free press have been working on this Gutierrez Soto case, offering up evidence why his reporting makes him a target. The immigration judge in this case has not been very keen on reviewing that information. What do you think is going on there?
I don't know, and I'm certainly not going to. Right now, I just want the top officials to understand that this is a man that will face very serious, real, violent threats to he and his family. And I don't think that that's right. And I think that we should be protecting him. And that's what part of my job is to do, is to protect the safety and freedom of the press. And this man was doing an invaluable service to people in this country, putting the spotlight on wrongdoing.
We've been talking with U.S. Representative Debbie Dingell, who, along with Fred Upton, is urging ICE to stop deportation proceedings of a Mexican journalist and his son because of expected retribution from Mexican soldiers who allegedly committed crimes that Emilio Gutierrez Soto reported on. Thanks, Representative Dingell.
Thank you. And thanks for helping to shed light on this. And I hope other people will speak up for freedom of the press. I don't agree with everything that's ever written, but our democracy and democracies around the world are under real and serious threat when we don't protect freedom of press, freedom of speech, too.
Cheers.
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 Hi there, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
It's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I walk in, and you've got a mortar and pestle out, grinding peppercorns, and you've got a bottle of green stuff that says arugula. What in the world are you up to?
Making a St. Patrick's Day cocktail, of course.
Well, it's going to be green. I can see that. So is this one of your own inventions?
Yeah, so I had reason to make some green cocktails a couple weeks ago, and I started thinking about how you can do that. And arugula makes a really nice syrup. You just blend it with some simple syrup, and you get this beautiful bright green syrup that has some of that nice peppery arugula bite. When I think about arugula, I think about that kind of peppery note that it has. So when I started thinking about how to use it in this cocktail, I immediately thought of Long Road Distillers Wendy Peppercorn Spirit. This is a flavored vodka, but it's really more like a gin, but made with peppercorns. So I decided that that would be a nice complement to the pepperiness of the arugula, and I mixed it up into a little bit of a gimlet variant.
So we've made a gimlet or two during this series, but I don't remember anything on the rim.
Right. So when I was making this, I thought it really needed a touch of salt, and it also just needed a touch of something else. The Wendy peppercorn is a great spirit, but I wanted the peppercorns to be a little more punchy. So I decided that it would be delicious and pretty if I were to put a rim on the glass. So I ground up some pink peppercorns with salt and used that to rim our glass.
All right. So you've got that on the rim, but how did you get that on the rim?
So there's a couple tricks that can take your rims to the next level. So a lot of people will just dip the rim of the glass in some liquid and then dip it in some salt, but that gives you salt on the inside and outside of the rim. So here I just carefully used a lime wedge to only put some moisture on the outside of the rim, and then I rolled it through that salt and pink peppercorn blend. So if you turn out to not like the saltiness, or you don't like the extra pink peppercorn, you're not constantly bringing more of that back into your drink as you sip it. And for the same reason, I also chose to only rim half the glass in case it was a little too much.
Got it. What do you call this?
This is the St. Patrick peppercorn.
Of course it is.
And to make it, I mixed about an ounce and a quarter of Long Road's regular vodka with 3/4 of an ounce of the Wendy peppercorn because it is really quite punchy.
The Long Road folks are going to love you.
And then I used 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice, 3/4 of an ounce of that arugula simple syrup, and shook that all up with ice and put it into our prepared glass.
All right. Well, this is really green. I'm going to take a taste of it. I did the bare rim side. I'm going to try it with the peppercorn.
Mm, I like that even better. I'm a nut for pepper. My wife says I overpepper everything. I just keep telling her it's a great antioxidant. I'm watching you take a sip as I was saying that, and you're like going, oh, yes, perfect.
Yeah, it turned out just like I wanted it to.
This green cocktail is a whole lot better than green beer, I imagine.
Anything's better than green beer, Lester. I like this because without the rim, it's a really easy drinking cocktail. So if you're someone who doesn't like super strong flavors, it's going to be appealing to you. But then once you add that extra punch from the salt and the pink peppercorn on the rim, that really takes it to the next level.
Yeah, I agree. Well, cheers.
Cheers, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.